rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode, we continue our series, The Exit Interviews. As dozens of MPs announce they're standing down, I ask them, why are you leaving us? Today, former MEP, former Minister Sir Robert Goodwill, on Dancing with Mo Molum, being sacked by Boris Johnson, and having to ask MPs if they can put off their chemotherapy in order to vote in the Commons. Another fascinating interview with someone you might not know particularly well, but gives you a real insight into the life of an MP and why he's standing down. Before that, of course, we'll have Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester, as we always do on a Monday. Today, taking a look at polling, which shows almost two-thirds of people would rather any extra money in the Treasury coffers was spent on public spending rather than tax cuts. So why are the Tories constantly talking about tax cuts? And don't forget, if you like what you hear on the podcast, you can listen to me live, Politics Without the Boring Bits, on Times Radio. You can listen for free on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits on Times Radio, weekdays from 10. It is a sad, sad day for Diddy Ron DeSantis.
And I can promise you this, you ain't seen nothing yet.
All right, I'd like to welcome Governor DeSantis for this historic.
We're just trying to get it going because there's so many people.
That's unfortunate.
All right, I'd like to
never seen this before.
Governor DeSantis for this historic. We're just trying.
All right, sorry about that. We've got so many people here that I think we are.
What they're trying to say with this is that in your boots you have heels.
No. Those are just standard off the rack Lucchese.
How tall are you, Governor? How tall?
5'11.
5'11. Okay.
But I have to put it to you, Governor. Have you ever eaten a chocolate pudding with three fingers?
I don't remember ever doing that. I'm telling you, maybe when I was a kid. Winston Churchill once remarked that success is not final, failure is not fatal, it is the courage to continue that counts. While this campaign has ended, the mission continues.
So Ron DeSantis pulls out of the Republican race. Turns out that's not even a Churchill quote at the end, and it probably originates from a Budweiser ad. So he might as well have suspended his campaign by saying,
Wazza! Wazza!
Wazza!
That's chipped down memory lane. Oh, what year was that? I mean, there was a lot of that going on when I was at school. What year was the WhatsApp adverts? I should have looked at that before. Come on. WhatsApp! Thank you, producer Owen. Bought me a cup of tea. Thank you very much. It's not my Andrew Bridgen mug. Has my Andrew Bridgen mug been stolen? What's happened to it? It's gone. Somebody's had it away. Oh, maybe it's finally cracked. Much like him.
The Columnists with Libby Rachey, Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester.
And we say hello to Libby Purvis. Hello, Libby Purvis.
Hello.
And we say hello to Rachel Sylvester. Hello, Rachel Sylvester.
Good morning, Matt Chorley.
Lovely, 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 lovely. Now, this all feels very retro. It feels like we're going back to about 2007, 2008. We're talking about the big society. Just don't call it the big society. Keir Starmer saying he wants to create a society of service, hailing charities and volunteers as the glue that helps bridge the gaps.
The Tories seem set on sabotaging civil society to save their own skins. They've got themselves so tangled up in culture wars of their own making, in its desperation to cling on to power at all cost. The Tory party is undertaking a kind of weird McCarthyism, trying to find woke agendas in the very civic institutions they once regarded with respect.
So this is Keir Starmer's speech to charities today, setting out Labour's position on the I think we sometimes call the third sector. Is this a rerun of David Cameron's Big Society, do you think, Rachel?
It is a bit, but it's really fascinating, isn't it, that how has the Conservative Party managed to get itself on the wrong side of the National Trust, the RNLI? They're sort of picking fights with these institutions. I think Liz Truss had the sort of anti-growth coalition, you know, the woke agenda. Whereas Starmer seems to be, it's not just the Big Society, it's sort of the Big Tent. He's trying to, he wants everyone in his Big Tent. And I went out with him a couple of week before last for a couple of days on his health tour. And he was talking to all the kind of health professionals in the NHS saying, I want to go into government with you. I want to do this together. And I gather there was a business breakfast recently where he said, I'll be going into government with you, with business. So it's this sense of we're all in it together. We're only going to change anything if we get all the bits of the system. So the government's got to do its part, business, but also the voluntary sector. I think it's fascinating. So it's but the interesting thing is the Conservatives are trying to pick fights with everyone.
Yeah.
Keir Starmer's trying to get everyone to like him.
Which, when you're 20 points behind in the polls,
well, it's a
making
curious
enemies is a
decision.
Is an unusual thing.
Yeah.
The flip side, I suppose, Libby, is that. One of the things that really baffled me about the RNLI was that a couple of weeks ago they turned down a donation from a fox hunt group who'd raised money for them. And I just thought, they're inviting that. They're picking a side, so they're inviting then others to pick a side. And actually, even Keir Starmer attacking the Tories for picking a side is him picking, you know, he could have done a speech and not talk about the culture wars around charities. What do you make of all this, Libby?
I think there shouldn't be these sides, and I mean it's quite clever of Starmer. I think the policy of let's do everything together, let's be together, is a good talking one. But I mean you ought to actually home in on particular Tory spokesmen, because we do know that the Conservative Party is basically mad as a box of frogs at the moment. You know, there's three different lots among the parliamentary party alone, and then out in the country. So if you could say the Tories this and the Tories that, I think it sort of doesn't work, because too many people think, well, actually our local MP, you know our local branch are actually very reasonable. I think the idea of creating huge sides and you're on the right one is divisive anyway. And I mean, he has to be a bit careful, because most people probably think that both the RNLI and the National Trust would be better governors for Britain than either of the political parties that we've had over the last 20 years. So it's a tricky one. But I agree with Rachel about this rather clever rhetoric of let's do everything together, rather than the, let's slam this, slam that, stamp on that, which is coming from not all the Tory party, but large bits of it.
I was really fascinated at the Tory conference. Every single speech virtually had some attack on woke. And I think they were, you know, even Steve Barclay, who was, I think, the health secretary at the time, his kind of big policy announcement in the midst of a major NHS crisis was something to do with transgender people in hospital wards. You know, so there were, and Kemi Badenoch talked about woke. They all talked about
and
woke.
There was, you know, Labour want to tax meat. You know, it was all
exactly.
Just sort of,
but
sorry, it was frankly not true. But yeah, they all felt the need to do it.
But I think it's the sense that they're preparing for a leadership contest that's going to come. So they were all, the beauty parade involved attacks on woke, which is, you know, fascinating. Whereas actually a lot of the people probably in the grassroots of the Conservative Party were or are members of the National Trust and the RNLI and all these great civic institutions.
And then Libby, as sort of, there is a thread that runs from this conversation about, you know, the role of society and community in you know, public life, to the subject of your column today, where reflecting on it's such a terrible story, this, the death of 2-year-old Bronson Battersby, found dead lying next to his father who'd suffered a heart attack. And actually, the way that community didn't come together, and that people sort of assumed that maybe someone else was sorting this out, and the squeamishness of knocking on a door or raising the alarm. Actually, you know, the ultimate tale of community not stepping in and helping out.
Yes, well, community, I mean, a lot of that community sort of did want to and wished they could. And of course, social services did the thing of knocking on the door and then coming back 2 days later and knocking on the door again. The child's life could have been saved probably at that second knock on the door, because it was 5 days later that they were eventually found. It's the most dreadful story. I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting, all this sort of showy talk about tax cuts and so on, that it is nonsense. Most people know that social services need a great deal more resources, and police need more resources, community resources. If we're not, you know, if we're not living in these tight little communities where all the grannies come round and give you a slap if you're doing it wrong, then, you know, we do need the state, and it does need money, it does need support, but it also needs a certain amount of extra power. I mean, I wish that the social worker had a key to the door, because it was such a fragile situation of a man with a heart condition and a child of two, you know, never going out because he had a bad foot, you know, and one report to the NSPCC. You know, this is a point where you have to say, actually, family, privacy and individual human dignity actually have to come second to saving two-year-olds.
But I suppose it all feeds in, doesn't it? And it's a point that Libby makes, Rachel, the this sort of sense of get the government out of my way, stop interfering in my life. It's PC gone mad. It's woke nonsense that social workers would have the key to the door. There's a great line, actually, in Libby's column. The me-first glorification of adult demands for self-fulfillment cascades down from applauded celebrities and affluent liberal middle classes to make life dangerous for those with fewer resources. And actually, a bit of nanny state woke interventionism is exactly what people are looking for sometimes when they're, you know, either financially distressed or in this case, you know, health.
Well, there's a sort of crossover with the free market libertarian argument, because actually there needs to be a sort of balance between individual responsibility and state intervention. And if you go too far either way, it's not going to work. I mean, I've been thinking about it with the Health Commission, because actually the government can help set a sort of more healthy food culture, for example, and individuals on their own can't do that. But we can't just subcontract the whole idea of health to the NHS. We have to take responsibility for ourselves and not have a whole diet of burgers and chips the whole time.
But it feels like
the concept of families is the family privacy is the really interesting thing, that now you simply can't, you know, because it's what everybody does and the world has changed and everyone switches partners every 20 minutes. And of course, you have children with three different fathers, that because you can't condemn, you know, you have to be more watchful, because these situations do become dangerous. You know, you're not saying everybody is bad who doesn't observe a Victorian moral code, but you are saying you are putting yourself in quite a lot of danger, especially if you have very few resources.
I suppose what says, I mean, this could clearly, exactly this tale could have played out with someone in a better financial and health position. But the fact that this family was already in contact with the social services, and they clearly were concerned enough to call the police twice, but not enough was done. And, you know, I'm sure it'll all come out in the inquiries and things.
It's just so sad that the father, or, you know, the snacks had been put just out of reach of the little boy.
Yeah, it's such a tragic story.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the extraordinary thing is that nobody was wicked. You know, nobody was malevolent. You know, this isn't one of those child abuse stories. It was a neglect story among people who wanted to do their best, but they didn't have the power and resources and background to do their best.
Well, let's move on then and talk about this question of resources, because we've been hearing about councils in financial trouble again. You know, that obviously then feeds into social workers, because that's where they get their money from. Jeremy Hunt still talking about wanting to make tax cuts at the budget, whether it's national insurance and income tax budget coming on March the 6th. In fact, here's Rishi Sunak speaking only this morning.
Because of our successful management of the economy last year in challenging circumstances, we managed to bring inflation down from 11% to 4%. We've now been able to start cutting people's taxes. So someone earning £35,000 this month, the tax cut kicks in. It's worth £450. Now, that is welcome. And we'd like to do more when it is responsible to do so.
Rishi Sunak speaking this morning. But a YouGov poll for the Times asked people that if there is some spare money, what should the government prioritise? 62% of people said spend more on public services, even if it means not cutting taxes. 22% of people said cutting tax, even if it means spending less on public services. In every single age group, voter group, part of the country, income, there is a majority, a straightforward majority of people in favour of spending more on public services. Even amongst those currently saying they're going to vote Conservative, 52% want more spent on public services, 36% want to cut taxes. Is this just a nonsense conversation that we're having, Rachel, where Jeremy Hunt spent £9 billion on cutting in national insurance before Christmas? It's done them no good in the polls. And the public mood seems to be, we'd rather fix the, you know, if you've got some spare cash, fix schools, hospitals, the justice service, social services, you know, right across the board, rather than spending money on tax. So why are they still banging on about it?
Well, I think the problem is that the voters feel this sort of crumbling public realm. They experience it every day, whether it's in waiting lists for the hospitals or rack concrete in schools or the trains that aren't running properly, or this awful story of social services, social care not available. And government's a choice. And, you know, that $9 billion that Jeremy Hunt chose to spend on tax cuts, that could have paid for reform of social care and mental health professionals in all schools. So it's by not doing that, he's making a choice, and he's trying. It started off as a cost of living argument, we'll put money back in your pocket, but the problem is that money's been outweighed, if you like, by the money that's gone down from other sources. So now they're moving it into a growth argument. We need to have tax cuts to generate growth, but that was what Liz Truss tried and blew up the economy. So I think it's a question of priorities, but the interesting question politically is that Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves don't really want to fight on this, because they are now ahead on the economy for the first time in a sustained way. So they don't want to say they'll do anything that differently, because they don't want to risk that.
And Libby, Paul Johnson makes the point in his column in the Times today that if there are any tax cuts before an election, whoever is in the Treasury afterwards will probably have to put them back up again to pay for it. In all this in order for Jeremy Hunt to meet his target that debt is falling as a proportion of GDP at the end of the five-year forecast, which is such a sort of muddly thing in the distance.
Can we just mention that Jeremy Hunt was the longest-serving health secretary we had, and before the pandemic we had fewer intensive care beds than any other comparable country in Europe and less stock of PPE. Jeremy Hunt is an economiser. Jeremy Hunt just, you know, he is fixated on these tax cuts, and given this poll, he's mad.
Well, there we are. No further questions. In fact, I spoke to Ben Bradley earlier, the Tory MP in Mansfield, because he was he's one of 40 Tory MPs making the case for more money for councils. And he said, I want tax cuts as much as the next man. Well, according to this, 61% of men would rather that money was spent on public services.
The interesting thing is the Tories won in 2019 on this coalition of kind of red wall and blue wall voters, as we call them. But actually, a lot of those new Conservative voters would rather have money spent on public services because they rely on it.
That was the Boris Johnson pitch. Away from get exactly. Brexit done, it was more police officers, 40 new hospitals. You know, it was very transactional. This is the shopping list of things I'm going to deliver.
And remember, Brexit was to get 350 million, whatever it was, for the NHS.
It's 100 years since the death of the founder of the Soviet Union, Vladimir Lenin. One of the most significant thinkers, of course, of the 20th century's ideas have altered the lives of billions. But what is his legacy today? In Russia, still littered with statues and images of his face, celebrations were muted. Putin has recast him as something of a villain over the years. Well, in the UK, a poll conducted by the Museum of Communist Terror in London asked people, do you have a favourable or unfavourable view of Lenin? 7% of people have a favourable view of Lenin. 45% said unfavourable. But among young people, 18 to 24 years, 15% said they had a favourable view of Lenin. A quarter So they had a favourable view of communism. Is this just what happens, that you start off left-wing when you're young and then you move right later on, or is there something more going on here? Dr. Helen Rappaport joins us. She's an author of Conspirator Lenin in Exile. Hi, Lenin. Hello, Lenin. It's too close. Helen and Lenin.
Yes, you know that in Russia, there were women called Ninel during the Soviet period. They christened them Ninel, which is Lenin backwards.
Well, there we are. I apologise, Helen, for calling you Lenin. What did you make of this survey? Is there an increase in popularity, sympathy towards Lenin and communism that is a sign of a changing public mood, or is it just the old thing about you start off left wing and get more right wing as you get older?
Oh, it's the youth flirting with extremism, socialism, communism, anarchism, you name it. I remember when I first went up to uni, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old, I joined the anarchist society. I went on the marches and the sit-ins and the demos. I threw flower bombs at Harold Wilson at Bradford. You know, you do that when you're young. You explore and you experiment with ideas. And very often with young people, the ideas tend to be on the left. What's interesting about this poll is that really until now, there's been this more of a resurgence of Stalin than Lenin. Lenin really has disappeared quite dramatically in the last 20 years. I mean, when I was in Eastern Europe, and especially in the Baltic states, they were yanking down all the statues the minute they could get shot at them. I think it's a phase, it's a fad. I don't think it's going to last.
We do see, Rachel, in some other polling, when asked, do you like the concept of democracy? Are you favourable to all that? Or would you rather have a strong man leader type? That's more popular, it seems, than younger people. And there's a slight sense that if the settled consensus of capitalism, globalism, has failed young people. They can't buy anything. They can't get on in life. You know, the last 20 years have been pretty grim economically. Yeah. No wonder you might start thinking, well, are some of these other ideas now worth returning to?
Yeah, sure. Although looking at this poll on Lenin, it may be 15% favourable, but 30% haven't heard of him.
Yeah.
38% actually. Yeah. So more than twice as many. So I think the 15% is slightly...
They're the hardcore ones. They've really signed up to the society.
And can I just add that?
Yeah, go on, Helen.
Can I just add that I was actually alarmed about 10, 15 years ago to discover my daughter, my youngest daughter's generation, she's now in her 30s, hadn't even heard of Lenin. Mm. They hadn't been taught about Lenin at school. And so Lenin had really fallen off his perch. And so I think the love affair with Lenin is a flash in the pan, really.
What do you think, Libby? You a fan of Lenin? What a question.
Well, I joined the anarchist club too, actually, and but they were so disorganised you could never find the meetings. But no, I had my own copy of the Communist Manifesto, and I can still sing you every verse of the Harry Pollitt song. But I think what it's about is disruptors. The young always value the idea of disruptors, something new and different. And now, of course, they're doing it with a sort of technical disruptors, you know, the sort of worship of people who are tech bros and will disrupt everything. I think that's very natural when you're young. You do not totally accept the world around you. And if you're not going to turn into that kind of cartoon Tory boy thing of, you know, everything is all right. And gradually it wears off. But I remember rather fondly my flirtation with communism until I started reading a bit more history and thinking, oh, actually, no, it's never been done properly.
The first thing that happened with me when I announced I was going to university in the late 60s to do Russian was, oh, you must be a communist, surely, to be studying Russian. And, you know, my father, who had a civil service job, had to announce to them his daughter was going off to do Russian because I might have been a security risk to
wow.
him.
Wow. Rachel, did you dabble with communism, Rachel?
I've never dabbled with communism. But I think the interesting thing is that shift from left to right is perhaps not happening in the way it once did. Mm. So there was another poll last week that among under 50s, the proportion of people, it was 60 to Labour, 10 to the Tories. So there's a real, it used to be by the time, what was it, if you're not a socialist, by the time you're 20, you've got no heart, if you've not a... conservative by the time you're 40, you've got no head. But that is being, that's breaking down, yeah, 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 partly because people can't buy their own home, as you say, they're not settling down in the same way. So back to our sort of other conversation, I think that's a real kind of long-term threat for the Tories.
A shift.
Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester, and of course you can read them in The Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk. Up next, why did Mo Molum pinch Robert Goodwill's bottom? It's the latest exit interview.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hey marketers, want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with Host Red sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book Host Red sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
The big thing.
We've already said.
So Robert Goodwill is leaving us soon. Goodbye. In 1956, he left his family farm to become first an MEP in 1999 and then Conservative MP for Scarborough and Whitby in 2005.
Not many people in their normal jobs get death threats, but, you know, we've had three or four over the years. You know, these people don't know me.
In his exit interview, he recalls standing against and dancing the waltz with a new Labour legend.
She did pinch my bum, actually. I think these days it would be quite a serious thing, but I said something a bit facetious, I think, and she dug her nails in quite hard.
Describes being a whip, having difficult conversations with MPs about the need to vote.
And I said to a colleague, well, could you have your chemotherapy on a different day?
And remembers being sacked by Boris Johnson.
Oh, Prime Minister, before you say anything, I know why I'm here. And if it's any consolation, Mrs. May sacked me once before, so I'm used to it by now.
So, Robert Goodwill, welcome to your exit interview. A chance for us both to learn what you could have done better. First question then, why are you leaving us?
Funny fact, if I was a doctor aged 67, you wouldn't be saying, why are you leaving the profession? You know, I mean, it's a 5-year contract. It will take me to 72 years of age. And I've got lots of other things I'd like to do. We've got a farm, obviously. I've got some hobbies. And we've got two fairly little grandchildren now. So it was always a plan to sort of leave around about now. I've been paying extra into my pension, so I'm retiring on the full pension. So why not?
Well, I suppose because if you look elsewhere, you're young to be a politician. If you're in America, you'd only just be starting to think about running to be president.
Yeah, and I think those two should have retired a long time ago as well, maybe. But I've been in this game now for around about 25 years. I was in the European Parliament before I got into Westminster, and that's a lot of weeks going away. You know, I never went to I think I went to one parents' weekend for my kids when they were at secondary school. I spend a bit more time at home, spend a bit more time. I've actually bought, we've got a farm up in North Yorkshire. Next year's our 175th anniversary on that farm. I actually bought a brand new tractor, which is unusual for me, so I'm looking forward to driving that. And I've got some steam traction engines, which one of which needs a lot of work, and they all need a little bit of work all the time anyway. So I'll be throwing myself into that as well.
We'll come to your collection of traction engines in a bit. What brought you into politics? Because you were, like you said, you were in the European Parliament first, before Westminster. How do you go from being, you know, you said, coming from a long line of farmers to then throwing your hat in with politics?
Well, I'd not really thought about politics too much. I mean, my mum was always the secretary or the treasurer of the local Conservative branch in the village. And I was very involved in politics at school and particularly at university. As I was doing my finals at Newcastle University, it was the election campaign when Margaret Thatcher got elected. And we, you know, we did go out with other students knocking on doors. So I've always been very political, but I never really thought I'd end up in Westminster or Brussels, maybe on the council. And then there was a by-election in 1986 when John Spence, the member for Rydale, had died, and we'd lost that by-election by a massive margin, a bit like things that happens now. The Liberal Democrats took the seat, and the local association said, we need a local man, we need a local candidate, and I rather naively threw my hat into the ring. I think there was 200 applicants, and I came second. And that was a big surprise to me because I thought I would be a sort of a non-runner, so to speak. And I was sort of advised. John Greenway got selected and he became the MP 13 months after that by-election defeat. And so I thought, well, yeah, I might have a go at this. So I applied for a seat for the 92 election in Redcar. First seat I applied for, I got, and sort of I've been either standing for election or getting elected ever since.
You were beaten by Mo Molum back then.
Yeah, she was lovely. Yeah, I mean, on the Saturday night before polling day, it was the mayor's ball in Redcar. Now, you know, don't get impression of sort of balls you might have in London. It was in the sort of leisure centre, and I know at they played the last waltz, and Marjorie and I got on reasonably well. I said, well, we shouldn't disappoint them. Let's have the last waltz together. So the picture in the papers on Monday morning was Mo and I going round the dance floor. She did pinch my bum, actually. I think these days we would be quite a serious thing, but I said something a bit facetious, I think, and she dug her nails in quite hard. That's not the sort of thing you can do now.
Does that tell us something about something that's been slightly lost in politics now? That, you know, now we get, you know, actually both sides of politics throwing abuse at each other, you know, quite personal vitriol. I feel like we're a long way from every candidate dancing the waltz with their political opponent the weekend before polling day.
Well, what you see in the chamber isn't necessarily, you know, what you see in the tea room or down in the strangers' barn. And, you know, I think a lot of us have very good friends on the other side. I mean, Tony Lloyd, who just died, you know, Tony's a great guy. We both have bus factories in our constituency, so we work very hard to ensure that when local authorities buy buses, they buy British buses, not Chinese buses. So, you know, we have a lot of good friends on both sides, and don't be taken in too much by what happens at PMQs.
Before we get sort of to Westminster, what was it like being an MEP, and how did it contrast with being an MP? Because, you know, I'm certainly the start of my career covering politics, you know, trying to get your head around what was going on in Brussels and who really mattered and where the power really lay. And actually quite a lot of power lay there, but nobody knew, you know, it was far less accountable, it seems, than what was happening so compare your two lives.
When I arrived in the European Parliament, I had a very big dose of imposter syndrome because I hadn't expected to get elected. I was number three on the Yorkshire list, and the opinion polls showed that we wouldn't have had it. And what actually got me elected, well, it was partly William Hague, remember, In Europe Not Run by Europe, yeah, which everybody really was attuned to, but also because it was the whole region voting. I think Barnsley Central had about an 11% turnout, and Richmond, at William's own constituency, now Rishi's, I think, had a 40% turnout. So although we were behind in the polls, we were picking up good seats in regions like Yorkshire. And so when I arrived, I hadn't really prepared myself at all. And it took me a little while to find my feet. But I sort of found it... it is... There's a frightening amount of power in the European Parliament. And what was particularly annoying is that, and I'm speaking to a journalist now, is that they didn't want to cover any of the serious stories. You know, you'd pass a big regulation about, you know, improving bathing water quality, improving air quality, making, you know, people safe in all sorts of ways. And the British press just wanted to know about straight bananas and you know, pink sausages. And
well, we know who was responsible for that. It was all Boris Johnson's fault, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. He has quite a lot to we can blame him for it over the years. But yeah, a lot of power in the European Parliament. And I have to say, the direction of travel when I was there was all about, you know, ever closer union. And that wasn't something that British Conservative members, by and large, supported. I think some of those that had been there for quite a long time were signed up to the deal. But the new influx that came in 99, we were definitely, if not, you know, in maybe not out of Europe, but certainly not run by Europe. And that was pretty much what we did for 5 years, trying to sort of hold back the tide a little bit.
You still voted Remain, though, when we came to the referendum in 2016?
Yes, and I mean, being a Eurosceptic didn't mean you wanted to leave. Mm. That was sort of Farage and the UKIP people. It meant about getting a fair deal. And I think if Cameron had got a fairer deal, we might well have been in a position to sort of sell continuing membership of the European Union. But, I mean, I voted to stay because I'm a farmer. And I've got to say, the common agricultural policy, it was crazy. You know, the fact that we got a tenancy in 1850 meant that we got a big cheque every Christmas and we didn't have to do anything really to qualify for that. And if anyone did threaten to touch the common agricultural policy, you'd see German tractors blocking the streets, as we've seen this week, and French peasants burning tyres in the road. So it was a great scheme for farmers. Now, of course, outside the European Union, we have to sort of sing for our supper a little bit more. And there's an awful lot more that we're now doing. We're still getting the support from the British government, but we're actually delivering these environmental goods. So actually, although it's a lot harder work being a farmer, and you've got to sort of do things and sacrifice land to get the support, being in the CAP was very comfortable indeed for farmers, and that's why I voted to stay.
Well, at least you're honest. What was it about the impact on you and your life? You've got two sons and a daughter. It's one thing being away in Westminster, being away in Brussels as well. What impact did it have on you and your family suddenly being thrown into this world of politics?
Well, I think it was a big shock, particularly my daughter was quite little at the time. She's the youngest. And I missed quite a lot of their growing up, that if I'd been on the farm, like all my friends and relatives, you know, I would have seen a lot more of that. So there was a bit of a sacrifice. And initially, you know, it was quite a novelty flying to Brussels every week, but that soon wore off. And I think often friends of mine who are in business say, ooh, you've been to Hong Kong on business. That's like a holiday, isn't it? No, actually, I just saw the airport and the hotel and a meeting room. And it was a little bit like that quite often in the European Parliament.
Any regrets about all that time away?
I've loved every minute, I have to say, almost every minute. And actually, you know, if I'd not done that, I suspect I'd have probably had regrets. Well, should I have done something different? And if you're a farmer's son, you're often sort of expected to take over the family farm. Your life's mapped out for you. And I actually, you know, drew a new map and did different things. And now, and certainly in my community up in Yorkshire, they all seem very proud of me anyway, and pleased that I've sort of done my bit, certainly for the country. Countryside and for the Conservative Party, where most of my friends seem to still vote Conservative.
They're the ones left. Let's turn our attention then to when you arrive in the Commons in 2005. Great news for you, but the third defeat for the Conservative Party. What was the mood like there in the Conservative Party? And then you had the leadership contest and David Cameron becoming leader and maybe a slight sense of turning the corner. But what was it like back then?
Well, I think many of them were very depressed, but that didn't really bother us because we just got elected. And, you know, mine was a seat that Labour had held since 97. It was a big surprise that Scarborough and Whitby went Labour in 97, and we were a little disappointed not to get it back in 2001. So when I came in, I'd taken a seat from Labour and I was, you know, enjoying every, you know, new aspect of being in Parliament. And, of course, I'd never been in government in Westminster, so I didn't really understand then just how depressing opposition is compared to being in government.
And so you then, quite quickly, you were sort of on the front bench, you joined the Whip's office, you were Shadow Roads Minister in the Transport team. Did you enjoy being on the front bench?
Yeah, I did. I mean, being in the Whip's office was fantastic. Actually, the reason I got moved to Shadow Transport was one Friday when we had private members' bills, that generally in opposition, you don't have a Shadow Minister for every debate that comes up, every private members' bill. And the first two collapsed quickly, and there was Angela Watkins and I left, and basically we had to do the front bench speeches for about five different private members' bills, and Patrick McLaughlin, who's the chief whip, was sat up at home in Derbyshire watching it, and he got Angela and I in on the Monday, said, "Oh, well done holding the fort on Monday, and by the way, Robert, I think you should move to a Shadow front bench team where you have a speaking role rather than the Whip's office." And I had 3 years at Transport, which was great because we were writing the manifesto for the 2010 election, and many of the policies that we dreamt up and put in that manifesto are now on the statute book, and we're very proud of some of the things we did. Because when I arrived after the election in 2010, the coalition was formed, so Norman Baker got my job that I should have had, and I went back to the Whip's office.
Because he was a Lib Dem, and they had to take some of those, you know, and you were one of the victims of the coalition in a way. So you're in government.
I was in the Whip's office, and I became pairing whip. But interestingly, what happened was when I finally did arrive 3 years later at the Department for Transport, all the heavy lifting had been done, getting, for example, legislation on roadside testing for drugs. We've got some stuff on HGVs. So when I arrived 3 years later, all the heavy lifting had been done by Norman Baker and Mike Penning, and I was there ready to take the credit, which normally isn't what happened. Normally, you do all the hard work, you're reshuffled, and somebody comes in and can cut the ribbon on that bypass or launch the legislation.
So you were the one who came and cut the ribbon and took the credit?
I cut a lot of ribbons on a lot of bypasses, but similarly, the projects that I signed off have only just been opened in the last couple of years, and I wasn't there to cut the ribbon.
Just explain, you said you were a pairing whip. For people who don't know, what is a pairing whip?
Well, being pairing whip is you're the one that lets people off to go to important constituency events or to have dinner on their wedding anniversary with their wives. And you work very closely, actually, with the opposition pairing whip. It was Mark Tarmey, he's still there. And it's all about sort of sharing out the numbers. So let's say a select committee is going to a visit to Canada, and there's four Labour and five Conservatives on that trip. We then pair them off, and that trip is plus one. But we had a majority of 83 in the coalition, so we could afford to lose one or two. We had people who were ill. I remember once having a very difficult conversation with a colleague when there was a crunch vote, when I think the Lib Dems weren't with us, in which case it got very tight. And I said to a colleague, well, could you have your chemotherapy on a different day? Now, there aren't too many jobs where somebody who's undergoing cancer treatment is expected to postpone that treatment just so they can come into work. And you know, we had some fairly tough crunch votes. If we had a really tough vote, we had three people with golden tickets, which meant that they were not expected to vote unless called in. And I remember once calling across to Number 10 and getting David Cameron to come and vote because we thought the Lib Dems were going to abstain or something. Actually, as it turned out, the Lib Dems did vote for us. We got a majority of 80. And David sort of tapped me on the shoulder and said, well, it was a bit close there, Robert, but I'm pleased you got me across.
So who else gets a golden ticket? The Prime Minister?
Well, prior to my becoming pairing whip, it was a Prime Minister, Chancellor and the Foreign Secretary. But on my first day as pairing whip, Theresa May, who was the Home Secretary, was flying across to Jordan and various places quite a lot to try and, you remember Abu Hamza, we had all that issue. So I actually rang Theresa up on the first day and said, would you like a golden ticket? And she said, what's a golden ticket?
I explained it
and she said, thank you very much indeed. And I hope that stood me in good stead at subsequent reshuffles when she was Prime Minister.
Well, it did. You ended up at the Home Office, immigration, then education, then at DEFRA. So you obviously seem to do okay.
I had a gap between education and DEFRA. I got the DEFRA job when George Eustace resigned, you may remember. Yeah. I mean, that was really sort of like a duck to water at DEFRA, I understand. I can remember the first meeting, Minister, what do you know about chlorothalonil? I said, well, it's a fungicide used in wheat and people saying it should be banned, and said, oh, well, that means we can go to page 5 of the brief.
I suppose that's your farming knowledge and your time in Brussels and so on. Meant that you could take to environment, food and rural affairs like a duck to water.
Yes. I mean, unlike when I went to education, when I'd really not done anything involving education before, and I was sort of starting from a clean sheet, I knew a lot about, I have a degree in agriculture, for goodness sake, so that worked very well. And I was there for 6 months, which coincided with the agricultural show season. And if you're the DEFRA minister, going around the shows, meeting all the farmers, giving speeches.
Trying all the food,
exactly. Yeah, drinking cider down in the southwest. And that, I was there until Boris became prime minister. And I'd backed Jeremy Hunt to be the prime minister. And so the first meeting I had with Boris after, I got a call to go and see him behind the speaker's chair. Now, if there's a reshuffle ongoing and you're not walking down Downing Street, you know it's bad news. So I went into the prime minister's office, and before he could say a word, I said, oh, prime minister, before you say anything, I know why I'm here. And if it's any consolation, Mrs. May sacked me once before, so I'm used to it by now. And he burst out laughing, and I suspect it was the easiest sacking of the day. But, I mean, I've heard of people sort of pleading for their jobs and bursting into tears. I mean, you know, in politics, we've got, 360-something MPs, or we did have, and you've only got 80 front-bench jobs. So, you know, you don't expect to be on the squad all the time. You know, you need to understand that you'll spend some time on the bench and get used to that.
Let's turn our attention then in your exit interview, Robert Goodwill. Let's turn to some of your former bosses, get your assessment on the various bosses you've worked for. So could you sum up Michael Howard in a word? He was the leader when you arrived as an MP.
Well, Michael Howard got me elected. You know, it was Michael Howard's campaign. You know, we were in serious trouble under Ian Duncan Smith. The polls were bombing, and Michael came in and in a fairly short period made quite a good fist of what had been a bad job. And you know, I'll always be grateful to Michael. He came to Scarborough in the campaign, and he made us look like we were electable again. We didn't actually sort of win the election, but it made us look like a party. And you know, he's a serious politician and such a nice guy as well. So,
some Michael Howard in a word.
Decent and honourable. That's two words.
That's very good. Last week, Charles Walker said he was scary. So he'll probably take decent and honourable. then along comes David Cameron. Sum up David Cameron in a word.
Very astute, I think. Good politician. I backed David Cameron in that leadership election because when I arrived in Parliament, we were straight into a leadership election. And there were all sorts of people sort of going round. And I probably would have supported David Davis. And if David had picked up the phone and telephoned me, given he's the only one I really knew, he had a Yorkshire seat, I probably would have come on as part of his team. But what happened was actually Derek Conway rang me and he threatened me, if you don't vote for David, it won't be good for you in terms of your career progression. And I thought, well, I'm not used to being talked to like that. David Cameron invited us round to his house, and Samantha was cooking lasagna. There was a lot of us there, and you could tell half of them were already signed up, and they were there to try and cajole the rest. The other half were there to be lobbied. And I sat on the sort of third step of David's staircase next to him, and he had a chat, and I thought, well, fair enough. I did support Liam Fox in that campaign originally, but when Liam got knocked out, then I went in for David.
And the lasagna worked. That's been repeated a lot.
It was the way I was approached. I think it made a big difference. Yeah. And who could be better as a foreign secretary with his diplomatic skills?
Yeah, lasagna all across Europe.
Yep.
Theresa May in a word.
Funny enough, I've got to know Theresa reasonably well since she stopped being Prime Minister. But when she was Home Secretary, when she was Prime Minister, I didn't really get to know her that well. And I think other colleagues may have the same thing. You know, she was a little bit distant. Maybe because she was always sort of off doing other things and not in the lobby.
She had the golden ticket.
She had a golden ticket. And she wasn't somebody that was in the tea room all the time. And actually, you know, since her office is just down from me in Portcullis House, and actually I bump into her most days, and we're actually reasonably good friends now. In fact, when I got my knighthood, Rishi, who was a chancellor, laid on me a little celebration dinner in Number 11, and I invited Theresa along, and actually sat her next to my daughter, which I think was quite an intimidating experience for the ex-Prime Minister.
Okay, so Theresa May, a bit distant, but you're friends now. Sum up Boris Johnson in a word.
Chaotic.
No further questions. I think that we've sort of probably covered that. What about Liz Truss? Liz Truss in a word.
She started off so well. I mean, I'm a natural tax cutter. She just wanted to do everything in the first 2 weeks. The problem was she only got 2 weeks or so to do that. And it was such a shame because, all during the summer, you know, I'd been going around on Rishi's campaign and she was saying, we need to cut tax, we need to do, you know, really, you know, come in very radically, you know, in some ways, a little bit like Margaret Thatcher was very radical. And Rishi was saying, well, you'll spook the bond markets, we'll get inflation going through the roof and the economy will bomb. And of course, that's what happened. And I think that's why when Rishi came in as Prime Minister, people thought, well, our heart said vote for Liz, but actually in our heads, we probably thought Rishi's telling us the truth. And so it came to pass. I feel desperately sorry for her. You know, she worked all her life to get the top job. And then it was snatched away from her in a very cruel way. And politics can be very cruel, particularly when, you know, when people get to the end of their careers. If you're a minister, you get sacked by the Prime Minister. If you're the Prime Minister, then it's pretty much the parliamentary party that can see the writing on the wall. Yeah.
What about Rishi Sunak then? Rishi Sunak in a word?
Just a genuine guy, really. And I mean, Rishi's got the next constituency to mine. When he was selected, there was a few raised eyebrows, actually, because, you know, we're not renowned for being diverse in North Yorkshire, but Rishi wowed them. I mean, there was no doubt at the selection. I wasn't there, but people who were there said, oh, yeah, it was just sort of, it was a complete no-brainer. Rishi got almost all the votes. Whatever he set about doing, whether that being a backbencher or, as he became quite quickly a minister, he just concentrated on doing it very well. And, you know, he's always been a very supportive friend to me and I will return that favour as much as I can.
Finally then, your exit interview, Robert Goodwill, some classic exit interview questions. What did you dislike most about the job?
I think the expenses scandal was the most terrible period. We sat in the tea room having breakfast and opening the Telegraph with trepidation to see who'd been accused. I mean, some of the things people did, you know, if you're a Nigerian politician, you've been accused of buying a tin of cat food using government money, I think most people would laugh quite hard. And that was a pretty torrid time. I didn't sort of have any problems with it, but we all were tarred with the same brush. I can remember going in the supermarket with my wife and people, friends of ours, you know, not strangers, say, pointing at, are those groceries on expenses? And it became quite embarrassing to be a Member of Parliament. And I think there's still quite a lot of that feeling around. So that was the worst time during the expenses.
I suppose that brings on to another classic question. Would you recommend the job to someone else? Would you encourage your children into politics, for instance?
Well, I think the problem is my children are on a career path where they probably will be earning more than an MP. And that's a bit of a problem. I have a very good friend in Scarborough who's fantastic, you'd make a great MP. And I said, you know, why not put your name in, get on that? He said, well, why would I take a 50% pay cut and why would I have my whole personal life and everything open to public scrutiny? And a lot of my friends are their own bosses, and that's one thing that my friends in agriculture don't really understand. You know, well, we're going shooting on Thursday. Would you come with us? No, we've got a three-line whip.
Yeah.
And they're not used to sort of having to sort of jump to other people. I think I would encourage people to go into politics, but I would give them a warning that there's quite a lot of flack. Now we've got, like, social media. There's some quite nasty stuff out there. You know, not many people in their normal jobs get death threats, but, you know, we've had three or four over the years. One guy got arrested, another guy lost his job just by making death threats to politicians. You know, these people don't know me. Mm. You know, they just sort of saw somebody up there and have a go at them. So, but I mean, it is great, particularly if you get to be a minister. And I've got to say, the best thing about being an MP is being a minister, and the worst thing about being an MP is being in opposition.
Which could well be where some of your colleagues are heading when you step down.
Don't write us off yet.
No, well. Finally, then you touched on it, but what will you do next? And tell us about this traction engine that you've bought that you're going to be tinkering with. It's quite a thing to collect.
Well, I'll be doing a lot of farming, and in fact, I bought a brand new tractor in the autumn, which we don't normally buy brand new. So I will be driving that quite a lot, I hope. But yeah, I've got a pair of steam ploughing engines, one of which is pretty much operational. We just need to do a bit of work for its 10-year boiler inspection. The other one needs a lot of work, so I'll be devoting my time to that. And I've also got a steam lorry, which is quite fun on the road. It'll go about 25 miles an hour, so I'll be tinkering with steam engines. And during the summer, I actually went to Holland because I managed to buy a steam plough to go with the engines. You have two engines, one each side of the field, and the plough gets winched backwards and forwards. And these ploughs are like hen's teeth to find. I managed to find one, and I went over on North Sea Ferries, or P&O Ferries as it now is, and picked it up and brought it back. So we're looking forward this summer to doing a bit of steam ploughing. And the summer after, a lot more steam ploughing, because obviously the election will have been by then.
Well, Sir Robert Goodwill, best of luck with it all.
Thank you very much.
Including with the steam plough. Thanks so much for joining us for your exit interview.
Thanks, Matt.
And that brings us to the end of this week's Exit Interview. If you want to listen to any of the others, just search Exit Interviews wherever you're listening to this. We're up to about 9 or 10 now, with more to come. And you can get in touch with me in all the usual ways. Email me, matt@times.radio, tweet @MattChorley, or find me on Instagram @MattChorley, or on TikTok, or indeed all of the platforms. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.